doing is giving a quick overview of some of my research, but I also want to be addressing some of the ethical questions that I have regarding the fact that I'm doing this research in the first place. My funding comes largely from the Institute for Environmental Security, which is a nonprofit institute based in the Netherlands. We get most of our funds from the European Union and from member countries, particularly the Ministries of Environment in the Netherlands and Germany. Now, the idea behind much of this research, skip through those. The idea for the research really is to look at environmental consequences of war. This has been done for a great many years, but not terribly effectively. Usually what's happened in the past is that people have tried to take the environment or health, for example, and then force it into a traditional national security framework, which, in my estimation, has been less than successful in most cases. What instead I wanted to try to do was to get some sort of idea upon what environmental consequences to conflict were, but in a way that was going to be policy relevant and of interest to people. And in part, this is drawn from a paper that I'll be presenting to policymakers at NATO later this month. So there is a good deal of interest, and also a good deal of support from the European Commission. Now, the background for this is, over the last few years, since 2004, the European Union has allowed in a number of new member states from former communist countries, and they've admitted now that they made mistakes along the way, that as the acquis process goes on, the acquis refers to the set of benchmarks that a country has to reach in order to attain European Union membership, that they didn't properly take into account the consequences, the unintended consequences of reaching that level of development. And they realized they had to go back to basics and decide, well, what needs to be done? What sort of development policies can we do which will take account of vulnerable populations, in which we won't have runaway economic development which doesn't take account of health issues, for example, which are not really a benchmark, or environmental issues, which are also not really a benchmark. As one quick example, there was a study that came out a few years ago which talked about landmine clearance in Bosnia-Herzegovina and concluded that landmine clearance policies were currently unjustifiable based upon their cost. Because if you do the calculations for the per capita GDP productivity of a Bosnian, then considering the number of people who are killed or maimed every year, it's simply not worth it. Once they become richer, then it'll be worth it. But of course, the consequences of this sort of thinking are quite profound, in that we really do have to go back to basics and look at issues related to the actual quality of life and who needs to be focused on, not just the aggregate, but particular groups who may be vulnerable. And the Balkans are a particular case. This area, which has experienced conflict really throughout most of the 1990s, including hundreds of thousands of people killed, millions of people internally displaced or as external refugees. And the environmental consequences of this were quite profound, but not really studied. And they're not studied for a number of reasons, mainly because the resources don't exist. But even if you look at health policies and health statistics, these don't exist either. The Croatians were able to maintain baseline medical statistics from before the war and after the war. The Serbians had medical statistics, although no one really believes that they're anything but fictitious. The Bosnians didn't really have anything. If you go there now to Sarajevo, they'll tell you that, well, we simply don't know what's happening in the country. We don't know who's at risk. We don't know who's dying of what. We don't know anything other than very basic mortality levels. So the idea behind looking at this is to look at the long-term consequences of the conflict. The conflict technically ended 12 years ago, but the effects of it are still being felt, and public health is one of the most effective ways of measuring what those consequences have been. If one looks at conflict in general, the environmental consequences can be either degradation of natural resources, either as an intentional or byproduct of conflict, and this can also be preparation for conflict as well, as happens in the United States. Or release of toxics. Toxics either consequentially as a result of bombing of industrial sites or deliberate release, such as defoliants. There can be munitions, which are considered, if you look at it from an environmental risk point of view, contaminants. Landmines are contaminants. Just as depleted uranium, just as cluster munitions, these are things which change the way that people use land, how they view the land, and the risk associated with living in certain areas. There are demographic shifts which have very severe environmental consequences as well. If you move millions of people from one place to another, the environment is going to change. Resource stocks are going to be taxed. They're going to have to look for other places to get things like fresh water. And importantly, this is actually one of the most important issues, the damage to infrastructure, particularly green or green-related infrastructure. This can be energy facilities, transportation networks, or much greener facilities such as, for example, water or wastewater treatment facilities. And one also must consider the built environment. If there's a reconstruction, the quality of housing, the quality and layout of the land, all the things that Howie Frumkin talks about with regards to sort of our lifestyles, you have to consider when rebuilding a community that's been ravaged by war as well. Now, some of the long-term considerations, there is, of course, the direct morbidity and mortality resulting from any sort of conflict, but also important are the loss of social capital and support networks. This has to do with the vulnerability and resilience of a society. There can be trauma, PTSD, and mental health-related conditions, and importantly, and if anyone here works on epigenetic issues, especially with endocrine-disrupting chemicals, I really need to talk to you. But essentially it refers to how these things are multi-generational. You can't simply look at the victims, treat them for a few years, and then stop. These consequences are going to last for many years. Now, the policy focus for what I'm going to be looking at in the field has to do with Swedish policies, Swedish reconstruction policies, and determining what the unintended consequences are. If these are meant to simply rebuild the economy, that's one thing. But they're very interested in making sure that they're not actually harming vulnerable groups along the way. And so I'll be looking at water-related infrastructure and health effects in Bosnia-Herzegovina. I will also be able to spin off from this small-scale qualitative case studies, which can be used epidemiologically. And I won't go into detail about this, but there are different methodological approaches to use for policy analysis, which can make judgments off of limited data and the necessary long-term needs for epidemiological studies. Now, one of the big problems, and I know I only have a few minutes to... I know I only have a short time to talk about this, but one of the big problems with doing these studies is defining what a vulnerable group is in the first place. It's sometimes considered just a professional judgment. Who do we study? Who do we determine as a vulnerable group? And I was happy to see in the Haiti study that you chose children, because that's the best way to go. Children are always safe, and they're often vulnerable. But making divisions in terms of categorization of different ethnic groups, using a geographical focus, so saying that people only in a certain geographical area are going to be more at risk than others, gender divisions, socioeconomic age, it makes a difference in terms of how people interpret these studies. And so just for a moment, I'll answer the question about what does vulnerability mean. The basic definition, and this is taken from disaster research, is that vulnerability has two components. There's first resilience. This is the ability of any particular group, whether it be a family or a community, to return to its former livelihood, to its former lifestyle. And this takes resources. It takes support networks. It's not just a matter of money. The more neighbors you have, the more friends you have, the more relatives who like you anyway, then the better off you're going to be after a disaster or a conflict. And related to this is sensitivity. Certain groups are going to be more sensitive to shifts than others. So if you live in a geographical sensitive area, if perhaps you're closer to the poverty level, you're going to be more sensitive to these events. And both of these have to be taken into account when looking at what a vulnerable group is. And really what you have to shoot for is to try for high resilience and low sensitivity. But you can have different combinations of these. The key one for my study has to do with the issue of resilience. And let me explain. When we look at the environment, and the environment was really my focus, public health was an endpoint. There are many different pathways, and this chart is really just a mnemonic for me. It's not causal, and it's not complete. But it gives some idea in terms of the different feedback effects and different ways that we can feed the environment into health issues. Because ultimately, we can't just, as in the lower left photo, you can't simply look at the damage that was done to this poor girl, but rather look behind her. What sort of life is she going to have growing up in that sort of environment? Now, I can contrast this with the photo on the right, which may not show up terribly well if you can still see the bullet holes in the side of the wall. This is Sarajevo 12 years after the conflict, and they're still trying to reconstruct the city. These things take a long time. And what these consequences mean for these sorts of children, these people growing up in these sorts of environments, can be quite significant. We need to take account of that in terms of defining what security means for people and what the consequences of conflict are. Now, vulnerability and conflict, to ID these vulnerable groups, we're often going to be looking at women, children, or minorities, whoever defined. However, we also need to look at the resiliency networks. We need to look at what was supporting these sorts of groups, what allows them to return to their former livelihood. Because in conflict, and the important difference that conflict has from disasters is that whereas in disasters, such as Hurricane Katrina, these resiliency networks are taxed. There's pressure put upon them, and then you can see where vulnerable groups come out. In conflict, these resiliency networks are actively targeted. One of the really sad parts about conflict, especially where you have ethnic cleansing or genocide, is that deliberate attempts are made to make sure that these groups cannot return, that they will be just wiped out from a particular area. And I should mention, although it's not environmental, one of the most effective ways to permanently damage a society is actually to sexually assault the survivors, especially women and children. If you do that widespread, there's no way for the community to recover. But it's possible as well if you look at infrastructure. If you ask the questions like, why do people burn crops? Why do they poison water? Or knock out water treatment facilities, which really has the same effect. Why do they, kill the livestock? It's meant to reduce these networks so that people can't return to their former lives. So we can look at vulnerability really as a political concept too, because for my role as a researcher, or our roles as researchers, to deem a particular group vulnerable is a political determination in many ways, because it's a judgment call based upon a number of different factors in which perception does count. I mean, if we do risk studies, you can't simply look at, what categorically actually exists in terms of a risk. It's a relative measure. You have to determine, well, people are relative, they're vulnerable relative to whom or to what. And it legitimates some form of intervention. Especially when we're looking at conflicts, usually by an outside force. And politically, this does make a difference. You have to historically also know what happens, because if we look at this in terms of environmental justice studies, then from political psychology, we know that people are going to always attribute certain causes to other groups. They're going to want to know why these things happen to them. Why is our health compromised? Why are we not recovering properly? Why are we vulnerable? And it's difficult, we often think in the States that, well, we understand these environmental justice issues. And over the years, I've seen people go to, for example, Eastern Europe and try and impose these ideas of environmental justice, not realizing that justice means different things in different places. Even the Hungarian word for justice, igazság, means something very different from how we understand it in English. And if you try and even explain environmental issues, in Serbian, they don't have a word for environmental. So imagine trying to explain these issues to them. So the dangers of studying risk are looking at how can you be neutral? How can you be neutral in a case in which people are going to be looking for some sort of outside attribution? They can have these sort of non-attributable anxieties where they're looking for some sort of explanation for why their lives are the way they are. If you as a researcher, we as a researcher, it's not just you, come in and make that sort of attribution, say that, well, you are vulnerable, but don't do the proper sort of political context of understanding what the nature of the conflict is, who's going to be involved, how are they going to see themselves. It's possible to sort of either re-victimize people or to make the conflict even worse. The concept of risk versus danger, I say this because in risk studies we have a definition that risk is something that's a probability of something bad happening to you. A danger is when you have no control over whether that risk happens. And if people feel they have no control, they're going to look for some sort of outside attribution to reestablish that control. Now, I'll end on this slide, but the photo here, this was taken during this past summer when I was staying with a Serbian family. Actually, they were Bosnian Serbs, but living in Serbia. This was in their entryway to their apartment. It's a 12-month calendar. One of my friends jokingly referred to it as the War Criminals Monthly. For those of you who don't recognize Radovan Karadžić and Zdravko Miladić, two very popular people who have open invitations for long discussions in The Hague. But they're seen as folk heroes in many parts of Serbia. people don't understand the conflict the way that we understand it. And if we go in as researchers and think that we understand these things without understanding the context of the conflict, if we start making determinations without understanding that, we could actually make the conflict worse. And the conflicts don't simply end. At best, they die out over a long period. But certainly in Bosnia, Serbia, Kosovo, it's not over yet. If any of you are interested, by the way, in the research that I'm doing, I can provide you with more information. But thank you for coming today.